You're listening to The Crossover with Joe R. Lucas.
Welcome back, my listeners. I know it's been a while and I've ignored so many of your direct messages and tweets asking me when we'll be back, but that was only because we're not sure when season 5 would start. But I'm personally honored and excited to say welcome back to The Crossover with Joe R. Lucas. I feel like we brought you the best that EuroLeague has to offer over the last 4 years. And why stop now? We've decided to start at the very, very top, and that's what we're going to do today. Today, I have the great pleasure to bring you the man that's taken over the offices of Barcelona, a man from the USA, has made his mark all over the world through his company, G2 Strategic, and now has taken on the task of CEO of EuroLeague Basketball. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Marshall Glickman. Mr. Glickman, how are you, sir?
I'm good, Joe. I dress like an Oregonian today, just for you.
You know, are you a football fan or a soccer fan for the American public?
Which version of football are we talking about,
Joe? I'm talking about the soccer version right now because we're in the World Cup.
Sure, I'm a fan. The fact is that, as we call it, soccer in the States is really, really growing rapidly. I mean, right. It's only been in the last 3 years where, when I was still living back in Portland, Oregon, I could turn on my TV set and watch EPL, Bundesliga, Serie A, League One, and of course La Liga, all on, you know, major platforms.
Major channels.
So including, you know, NBC, you know, on a, you know, so, and then on top of that, Major League Soccer, which is really, really growing, and I think to a good extent is a model for where we can go here with EuroLeague.
I don't know if you remember the conference you did. I'm sure you've done so many with the front runners.
Yeah.
With Active Media in Greece. Of course, we have a mutual friend in Demis. Demis is a very good friend of mine. I actually, through my research, talked to him a little bit about you also. He had nothing but good things to say to you. But I was a part of that also as an ex-athlete that turned into a business person, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And I was really amazed. I'm going to bring that up a lot here during the interview, but I was really amazed by that presentation and what you had to talk about the Gen X and the Gen Z. It was so insightful, things that I've never heard before.
Oh, thank you. I mean, you know, that's what I'm here to do, disrupt.
Well, I got to tell you, my certain time, if you didn't study me or have anything, no idea about me, I did play with the Kings for back in 88, 89.
No kidding.
I was drafted with the same year as Kenny Smith. We had Ed Pickney, Harold Presley.
Did you play for Jeff Petrie?
No. I played for Bill Russell and Willis Reed, if you could believe that.
No, Bill was the head coach?
Bill was my head coach, and he made it about 3 weeks longer than I did. I made it to the cutoff deadline, the guaranteed cutoff deadline, and he made it about 2 weeks later than I did.
So I knew Bill a little bit because when I worked for the NBA back in the kind of early to mid 80s, I had the pleasure, as it turns out, to travel to all the national TV games every Sunday. You know, I was basically the eyes and ears of the NBA on site during all the network games. And that first year, Bill was a color commentator, and I got to know Bill, and he, great sense of humor, really, really interesting, you know, well-read, really, you know, of course, what he went through, and, you know, and in terms of race and everything else in the 60s. Yeah. Wonderful guy, really. So that's cool. So Jeff Petrie came when to Sacramento?
I think he, like I said, my time was limited there. that was about the time Michael Jordan was coming. So they needed Mike. They needed Mike to be the number one star. They needed to get rid of me. They needed to remove me from the NBA.
Well, you know, it happens, Joe.
In.
Sorry, man. I know this is your interview. I'm only asking about Jeff because, as you know, he was the first Portland Trailblazer. He was my good friend. I used to go to his camp when I was a kid as a player.
Yep.
But later on, he and I were running the Blazers together. Eventually, after Paul Allen bought the team, he was let go, and he went to Sacramento, and he brought Rick Adelman, and they had a really great run with Jeff and Rick over a long period of years in Sacramento.
Yeah, it was similar. The reason why I brought that up is how much I loved Portland. It was one of the places that I did get to go to, and I actually just fell in love with the city. It's a beautiful city. And of course, that's where you grew up and your family, right?
Yep,
let's get into your father. Your father was the founder, essentially, of the Portland Trailblazers, which I think is amazing. The whole story about him looking for investors, the NBA giving him a franchise. I think it was $3.8 million at that time.
The best story, I mean, I could go on for hours, but he's in one meeting with the NBA Board of Governors making a presentation. You know, back in those days, no PowerPoint, just your mouth.
Right, yeah.
And trying to tell them that Portland ought to have a team. I think this is like 69, it might, something like that, because the first year was 70. And so he's in this meeting, and there's a guy named Ned Irish, who's the president of Madison Square Garden, which is the New York Knicks. And he looks across the table and he says, "I can't put effing Portland on the marquee of Madison Square Garden." Okay. So this was the arrogant New York, the hell is Portland, Oregon perspective.
East Coast mentality.
Exactly. So my father used to love to tell that story. But yes, when I grew up in hockey because he started off as a promoter of independent sporting events, fights, especially boxing in those days in the 50s. And he even did some entertainment. He did Liberace. He did a Judy Garland tour, which is why he got out of the entertainment business.
That's my favorite story that I read, that she didn't want to go out on stage one night.
So he had her on a mini tour of the Northwest, like Portland, Seattle, I think Spokane. And every place she would go, in the morning, there'd be a press conference. She was a huge star. This is Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, okay?
Yeah, of course.
She's a huge star, but she was a drunk. And so she was a serious drunk. And at the time, she was married to Sid Luft, who was the father of one of Judy's daughters, who became an actress herself, named Lorna Luft. And so there'd be a press conference in the morning in the hotel, and she's supposed to be downstairs with her manager, who's her husband. And she's not there. So my father, who's not a man that was known for patience, gets on the elevator and goes up to where her room is. And he knocks on the door, and Sid Luft comes to the door and opens the door, but just a crack. So Harry's still in the hallway and he's going, "Hey, Judy's late. She needs to be downstairs." There's 50 press cameras downstairs, big star. And he can see Judy Garland over Sid Luft's shoulder, sitting at the table, wearing like curlers in her hair, bathrobe, no makeup, a bottle of whiskey. I'm not joking about this. This is 10 o'clock in the morning and she's already into the whiskey, okay? And she's hammered, and she started screaming expletives at my father, telling him to get the F out of, out of her room. And so my father, in his own way, went downstairs, all the press are down there, and said, "Well, Judy's upstairs in her room and she's wearing her robe and she's got curlers in her hair and she has no makeup." He didn't mention the alcohol. "So she won't be able to be with us today." He wanted to make sure the press, knew what was really going on.
That's great. It's amazing when you talk about that, little sweet Dorothy from...
Yeah, little sweet Dorothy. With, holding Toto.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you had a college life. You studied in Portland. You worked for the Trailblazers as the senior vice president. But I also heard that you sold cable TV packages door to door.
Yeah. Well, when I got out of school in 81, I swore up and down that I would never work for my father, because all of us want our independence, right? We all want to feel that we can make our own way. And I wanted to show myself and my father that I could. So I actually moved to Los Angeles with no job. I had a Fiat 128, which is a very small, light Fiat. And I drove to LA and I filled the car, not with clothing, but with my record collection, because I'm a collector of vinyl. And vinyl records are heavy and they take a lot of space.
Of course.
And back then I had maybe a couple thousand.
Hey, remember, we're about the same age, so I know exactly what you're talking about. When you talk about 8-tracks and vinyls, I'm with you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still buying vinyl, just so you know, all over the world. Well, so I've got a growing collection.
It's a new thing now. People love these new vinyl records.
You can't replicate the sound quality. It's fantastic in the packaging. Anyway, and by the way, my 22-year-old son's into it too, which is a very expensive habit, but better than better than other things, right? But anyway, exactly. So I packed all my records, which basically it was so heavy that the shock absorbers were worthless, you know. And I remember driving over the grapevine into L.A. It was like really crazy. Anyway, I moved to L.A. I had no job. And I started pounding the pavement looking for a job. And I wanted to be in the music business. And I found a gig with a radio syndication company that was producing jazz radio programs. And I have a thing for jazz and still do. And so I went to work for a company called Syndicated Inc. And I was the only employee. And so I asked him what my title could be. And he said, anything you want. And so I said, okay, I hereby name myself assistant to the president, because you're the president. So I became assistant to the president. It was cool because he didn't have a lot of money. It was kind of a one-room office. But it was in a very famous building called the Hollywood Taft Building, which was kitty-corner to the round Capitol Records building where the Beatles signed in America. And across the street was Merv Griffin Productions, which was just beginning to do Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy. I went to work for this guy, and he didn't have production studios, and he didn't have high-speed tape duplication, which we needed. So he used another radio syndication company who had that equipment, who were in the building, and it was called Audio Stimulation, which was Wolfman Jack. So I got to know the Wolfman a little bit. I had an amazing time in L.A., but, you know, I was poor, you know, so there was no money. So I couldn't afford to buy tickets to the Rolling Stones when they came, which really bummed me out. So
not even being assistant to the vice president.
No, he paid me bumpkins.
There was no perks.
Yeah. And by the way, he paid me in cash under the table. No tax withholding, nothing. Okay. So I got back to Portland and I got a really cool job, which was selling cable TV subscriptions door to door. And they were just laying cable in Portland. And I had to knock on people's doors at night, you know, when people were home from work. So it was dark and cold. And I'd knock on the door and I'd say, hello, I'm Marshall Glickman with Rogers Cable TV. And I'd like to talk to you. And, you know, usually the door slammed. But, you know, I learned how to kind of talk my way in. And I had to talk my way into people's living rooms and take a seat and explain to them why they should pay for something that they've never paid for before, that they had for free. And ultimately, I was pretty good at it, and I learned how to sell, you know, and that to me is one of the core attributes of the great executives. If you really look at the great executives in our business today, many of them have roots as salespeople originally.
Right.
And one thing led to another, and I ended up at the Trailblazers doing what I said I would never do, which was sort of indirectly work for my father. I never worked for him because I needed to prove to everybody else in the company, who of course knew me, that, hey, man, I can do my thing. So I worked very hard never to walk into his office, for example, during the day, because I didn't want it to look like I was going to daddy. And I got very close with a guy named John Spolstra, who is the father of Eric, but at the time was the kind of, I don't know what we called him, VP of marketing or something for the Trailblazers. And John was brilliant and was one of the first great disruptors of the industry. And I learned so much from him, and he became a mentor and a friend. And so I really, my career got off to a good start working with John.
The good and the bad thing about sales is that you learn how to accept rejection in a way that, like, nobody's business. And that's when you start learning how to win. When the sales start outweighing the rejections, it's a lot more fun that way. But everybody has to go through that process one way or the other.
Right. And, you know, players have to learn how to deal with losing. Do coaches and general managers. In Europe, people take losing harder than they do in the States, don't they, Joe?
We'll get into that as the conversation goes. I want to kind of get into that front runners thing, but I've been a huge fan all my life of every sport. I played every sport when I was growing up. I was actually drafted by a AAA team to play baseball out of high school, which my father was like, no, you're going to college and you're studying, because we didn't have much money. And I was a Dolphins fan, Cincinnati Reds fan. And when you guys, when Portland beat the 76ers in 77 with Dr. J coming from the ABA, I was devastated. 7 years, this this NBA team's been around, and you beat Doctor, and you beat all that, you beat my whole team, and it killed me.
That's because we had the big redhead, right? I mean,
exactly, you know, exactly.
I mean, we this dude, you know, he was he, you know, unlike today's big man, he couldn't shoot. I mean, he right. had no outside game. He didn't have any ball handling skills. But he was the best
let me just say to listeners that the big redhead is called Bill Walton.
Yes.
Oh, just so everybody knows.
So, I mean, this guy, though, he could see his vision and his ability to anticipate player movement. And so the ball, it was like a great quarterback in football.
Right.
His passing skills where the ball would be waiting for the player as the player was making a cut or coming around a pick. Incredible. His passing skills from up above, and he could run. So Ramsey, who was a great tactician, they could run plays from the high post, free throw line extended for Bill, or they could put him in the low post. And from the low post, he could score a little bit. You know, he could score enough to keep him honest, right? They had to guard him. But his ability to see players cutting and make the perfect, you know, perfect pinpoint pass. And, you know, Ramsey was similar to European coaches. He wanted layups, not threes. So he got a lot of layups with Bill in the post.
He seemed like one of those guys that you admire because, like you said, that passing ability, it's because he's actually three steps ahead of the play.
Yeah,
he knew what was going on before everybody else knew what was going on.
He had a great cast of characters around him. It was almost, in a lot of ways, it was sort of the perfect team because of their ability to play as a team. There was no real star other than kind of Walton, but he didn't play as a star, selfish kind of player at all. He wasn't a stat guy, you know, and they had really nice supporting cast around him and got, you know, Maurice Lucas especially, but, you know, others. And it was just a great moment. But the thing that, for me, I grew up in Portland, right? So I'm telling you, you know, we had a parade 2 days, I think one day, I think it was the next day. It was June 5th, 1977 was the date of the championship. So the next day was a parade in Portland that went from Memorial Coliseum, the home arena,
mm-hmm.
through the center street, Broadway. It's always Broadway in every American city,
yeah,
you know, up
course.
Broadway. There were a million people, man. I mean, there were a million people. It was unbelievable. And it culminated in some park where there was all the speech making. And I'll never forget Bill Walton standing in front of the mayor of Portland, who was a very young, up-and-coming guy named Neil Goldschmidt. And he took a beer and he poured it over the mayor's head. It was one of the great, you know, it was just classic. Just classic.
And then he took off to a Grateful Dead concert right after.
Yeah,
afterwards.
Exactly. Well, he's a huge Deadhead. He still is. I'm still in touch with Bill. I love the guy.
Yeah.
He was a different guy back then. I could tell you so many stories, including his roommate,
imagine.
Jack Scott, who was famous for harboring Patty Hearst when she was a fugitive. But, you know, that's a story for another day.
Talking about the fact that I was a huge Sixers fan, a Dolphins fan, you know, to the point where they, you know, I was watching the game with my parents. I wouldn't even let my mom get up and cook her pasta, you know, because if the Dolphins were winning, I'm like, don't get, you know, you can't move, you know. But it kind of took effect in that Gen X, Gen Z presentation that you had in the Front Runners. And I feel like that's a little bit of what we're losing in today's world. Of course, in Europe, there's a lot more emotion, a lot more dedication to certain teams, your Barcelona, your Real Madrid, your Panathinaikos, whatever, whether it's soccer or football or basketball. But that's what I feel like the difference between, like you said, the Gen X and the Gen Z. People don't have favorite teams anymore. They're not brought up that way as much.
No, this is right. They have players. People are drawn to other people, let more than they're just drawn to some team just because you wear the emblem of a team, you know, for all your life. Now, I will admit to you, I'm kind of in between on this, right? So, like, because in Oregon, I'm an Oregon Ducks fan. And over here, which is a University of Oregon, are called the Ducks.
Right, right, right.
And, of course, that's more similar to the situation here, say, with Barca or Real Madrid, where you've got one club that has multiple sports under the same brand, same colors, same emblem. And, you know, I'm a loyal Oregon Ducks fan because, and I did not go to school there, but my son goes to school there. My father went to school there. My sister went to school there. I love the Ducks. I also love the Boston Red Sox. So it doesn't matter who's playing for the Red Sox. I'm sorry, you're a Philly guy, right? Is that what you said?
No, Cincinnati Reds,
oh,
actually.
Oh, okay. All right. So I'm a diehard Red Sox guy. But the reason I am, it's a strange thing, is really the venue. I lived in Boston for a couple of years. I fell in love with Fenway Park, and I decided this is going to be my team forever. And it has been my team forever. And I was not a baseball fan before I moved to Boston, really. And Boston turned me into a real baseball fan.
Well, I played at Niagara University, so one of our yearly trips was Northeastern, BU, in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And that the first time I went to Boston, that was my first trip, because I was a baseball fan growing up my whole life. I hated basketball, to be honest
yeah.
with you. And
yeah.
And first thing I did was I had to go to Fenway. That was like one of the most amazing places.
Yeah, it's a temple. But, you know, I look at my son, who's my sort of day-to-day research guy, right? Because he's 22. He was a multi-sport athlete. He grew up playing baseball, football, and was a ski racer. Also, believe it or not a basketball player in the winter.
Winter ski, snow ski.
Snow skiing, alpine skiing.
Snow ski, okay.
And which made him a damn good skier. He doesn't race anymore. But he's a huge NBA fan. Huge NBA fan. And he follows players. And, you know, he loves the Blazers, right? Because that's his hometown team and his grandfather's team. But he follows players. And he follows the NBA, as I think most of his generation, in short clips. You know, he's not, unless he's at a game physically, he's probably not going to sit on the tube and watch a game from start to finish. He's looking for highlights. He's looking for content. He wants to know what's happening behind the scenes. He wants to know what music players are listening to. He wants to see the fashion around it. He wants to know who the girlfriend is of the player.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, he wants to know what's happening, you know. And so I think that's where the demand is at. I think that's global. I think, you know, the phone, for better or worse, has kind of changed. You know, it has. You know, I think popular culture is popular culture generally across the globe. And the NBA, the difference between the NBA and, say, your league today, is that the NBA is part of popular culture in the United States.
Right.
It's not really just a basketball league. And I think the reality is, for us here at EuroLeague, I'm not saying we have to become that. We certainly not. But I do think we have to pay attention, very close attention, to the sensitivities and the desires of that next generation, particularly Gen Z. But let's not forget, you know, the millennials are old now. So I'm paying attention to the Gen Zs, but also Gen Alpha, which is behind Gen Z, and they're next. And right. what they're going to want as far as content and how they're willing to consume sports is very different from my generation. And so we have to adapt ourselves and try to be ahead of the trend line as much as we can.
As you're speaking about your son, and let's say not his attention span, but what he really wants to focus on, we've been developed to have a shorter attention span nowadays. You know, I don't want to watch a movie anymore, but I want to watch a miniseries. You know, I want to watch a documentary that's, you know, 45-minute clips, and I watch it. But to me, like, the biggest invention ever, which happened, I think it's probably 12 or 13 years old right now, and if you're an NFL fan, you know I'm talking about, it's the Red Zone. Red Zone is like the greatest product that, you know, since sliced bread. Red Zone is, for people that don't know what Red Zone is, it's one channel, one person who brings you 8 games at a time and goes back and forth from game to game, and all you do is see the action. You see the fumbles, the interceptions, the touchdowns, and it's an amazing product, but that's kind of what started to turn this generation, other than obviously the phone and the internet. And it's things like that that you look at and you're like, man, how can anybody not have thought of this 30, 40 years
ago? Yeah, I mean, it's so obvious, isn't it? And, you know, I'm frustrated for various reasons that we're not able to have that kind of product here today yet. We will.
Right.
I mean, I'm going to push in that direction because, you know, if I walk into a EuroLeague arena and there are video screens in our arenas, you know, sometimes better, sometimes less better, but there are video screens. Right. And, you know, we've got new arenas coming online with better. But, you know, if there's another game happening somewhere else, that game should be on live on that video screen when people are walking in. That game should be in the hospitality rooms and in other places around the arena. But also, if I'm at home watching a game here in Spain on DAZN, I can go, you know, there's multiple EuroLeague games on at the same time, which I like because I can toggle between games. But if I'm particularly interested in watching one game, I'd like to see some live cut-ins and some other, you know, I think the European EuroLeague fans, I know they're very committed to their clubs, no question, but I'd like to share more of, you know, what you're calling, you know, the highlights that are coming from other games, because all the other games affect their team too. So, you know, but we have a ways to go, but we're moving, I think, in a positive direction in that sense.
But how do we do that? And when I say we, because I, you know, because I'm in the media, I'm doing the commentating the games, and I love all that. I love, you know, I've proposed the idea of like Manning Night Football, for example. I propose like a PTI show, you know, for EuroLeague. How do we do that with a multifaceted culture of different countries that believe different things and see things differently? And how do you combine all of those facets and bring them together as one so that you have an agreement, let's say, to be able to do that? And then how do you go out and search for these people? I mean, I'm asking you this as a CEO of the EuroLeague.
These are fundamental questions, and I can't tell you that I have all the answers, because I don't. I mean, let's start with that, okay? Because the truth is, in the States, one country, one language, no problem.
Right.
Here, especially language, is a big problem, and as you say, culture. And when we go into a country and we're producing a game for television, as you know, the standards can be very different from one to another, whether it's from the perspective of equipment or the people who are operating the equipment, the quality of directing and producing, fantastic in some places, less so in others. So there is that challenge. It's a constant challenge. I love your idea of Monday Night Football. I think there should be EuroLeague, whether it's probably won't be Monday, but whatever night.
No, no. I said Manning Night Football. Where Eli and Peyton,
the Manning.
Yeah,
cast.
Manning.
Well, but this all goes together.
And, yeah, of course.
I will be very straightforward. I would like to see one game, maybe more eventually, but let's start with one game. One of our games every week. Be the game.
Right. Game of
and
the week.
I would like to put that game out across a single platform, but in multiple languages, multiple graphics packages, with multiple announcers, both play-by-play and color, and maybe even reporter, on site. Doing commentary from a studio, from my point of view, is unacceptable. And I think we're just now at a place where the technology is catching up with the dream that I have to do that. And then, to go to your point, that then gives us the ability to have multiple options to watch the same game, whether that was through a Manning cast, which is absolutely wonderful. For people in your audience that don't know, it means that the same game that's on one network is also on a different network where you can watch the Manning brothers, Eli and Peyton, as though they're sitting in their living room just kind of BSing about the game. It's fantastic. Yeah. So multiple feeds reaching specific target audiences of the same game across multiple languages would be the dream. And so there could be a feed that is designed for people who are placing wagers on the games. There could be a feed for people who want a different perspective. That's like Manning cast. The NFL also did a deal last couple of years with Nickelodeon.
I was just going to get into that.
It's awesome, right? It's just awesome because the graphics were fantastic, totally different. The whole way and you know, it's just like, you know, they're reaching a very young, you know, what, 5 years old, 10 years, six, seven, But they're teaching them the game. They're teaching them the fun parts about the game, what's fun, and they're animating things. And, you know, I've had conversations with people that represent Marvel who are interested in coming over here and doing something with us where we turn players into Marvel characters. And these kinds of ideas is how you begin to nurture and build new audiences.
The Nickelodeon concept brought like 2 million people or 3 million into the first episode where they had like the green slime guy, you know, at the 20-yard line. And
it's fantastic.
And what you're doing, you're capturing an audience before they even know what they like. They don't know if they like football. They don't know if they like soccer. They don't know if they like baseball. But NFL went and captured that audience beforehand.
The NFL is brilliant. They really are.
It's amazing.
And the NFL, what do they sell? I mean, right? They're not really selling the game per se. I mean, the game is, you know, obviously at the core, but it's the fun. They're making it
fun.
It's a show, and they're making it fun to be in the stadiums or to watch on TV. And now they're giving it to you in all kinds of different ways. And that's brilliant. And it's more challenging to do that in Europe for the reasons you said, but I think it's doable. And certainly I'm hoping that we can move more in that direction.
You say it in one way and I say it in another way. I say it's like reach the plateau or the plateau line, and you say status quo. I feel like at times it's kind of where your league's been. Like we have the product's amazing. To me, it's the best product, the best basketball product around. I mean, I love the NBA. I love watching the NBA. But for 82 games of the season where guys can take off three nights in a row, it doesn't matter if you win or lose, this product's number one. But I feel like there's been that status quo for a little bit where we should have been growing more with this product. What are your ideas to help this product grow and to make it not, obviously we're not going to make it into the NBA. Let's not, you know, fool ourselves, but make it something similar.
Not only are we not going to try to be like the NBA, I don't even know if we want to be similar to the NBA. I think we want to be different than the NBA. And then, you know, for basketball fans, fantastic. But we also need to reach people who are not necessarily devoted or kind of hardcore fans. We need to reach the outer ring. People who just enjoy having fun.
The inner ring is the easiest people to reach. They're going to be there regardless of what you do.
And I mean, I think there has been, for good reason, in the evolution of things. But, you know, there's been much more of a focus on the kind of the core basketball fans. And it's in Europe, it's limited. And it depends on the market. But the fact is, the biggest basketball markets where basketball is the most popular, you know, Greece, Lithuania, Serbia, these countries, Turkey, obviously. So, you know, these are great fandom countries, but these are not where the strongest economies are in terms of just gross spending power and GMP.
GDP,
so
yeah.
Where we have opportunity to really grow, to balance all that, because we don't want to lose these important basketball markets. They're really important. Israel, too. I mean, these, you know, and if Russia comes back at some point in the future also, these are important markets. But at the same time, where we have opportunity or what I call white space, Germany, France, Italy, really, because Italy's always been an important basketball country, but we only have one team in Italy, and it's, you know, obviously dropped a lot.
When we were young, Italy was the main point of European basketball for us because it was Bob McAdoo who was the first
American baby.
Exactly. Who was a Buffalo Brave right down the road from me in Rochester.
You know, another side story, but, you know, we had the number one pick in the draft that year. We did not take Bob McAdoo. We took LaRue Martin. another wonderful human being who lasted 4 years in the NBA and then worked at UPS for the rest of his career and became a high-level executive there. Also, I'm in touch, believe it or not, with LaRue.
That's one of the negative perceptions of Portland. They've had such bad luck over years with first-round draft picks. But that's another thing.
Yeah, that's been overplayed. We drafted Terry Porter. We drafted Jerome Kersey. We drafted Cliff Robinson. We drafted Lionel Hollins. We drafted Bobby Gross. We drafted Johnny Davis.
I just had a couple that hurt. No one cares.
It's because we drafted Sam Bowie instead of Michael.
Marcel, you know enough to know that no one remembers all the positive things. You only, you know, the negative things are the things that show up.
So anyway, we won't talk about the Blazers anymore. But No, I think that there's a lot of white space for growth, point one. Point two is there's opportunity using and taking advantage of new technology and the ability to do things that we already discussed to reach new audiences, focusing especially on kind of the lower end of millennials, Gen Z, and ultimately Alpha coming up. And I think that's really a big opportunity because basketball, the nature of the game, the nature of the players being close to the people, maybe more accessible than the football players, I would argue. Certainly better looking. No, just joking. But, you know, I mean, right? I mean, I think it's a combination of kind of our game, what we can do around our game that is going to really appeal. And the content we can build around that is going to really appeal to those generations. So that's our focus. There are numerous things that we're doing to try to, you know, begin to take advantage of those opportunities. And we could spend hours talking about it. But believe me, you know, now that I'm beginning to get my arms around things, and, you know, trying to, you know, talking to the clubs, doing a lot of listening, reaching out to FIBA, doing things that I think are important to do, I think you're going to see a lot more, you know, change and disruption in a positive way in the next year. I'd like to see this be, you know, frankly, more of a players league and put the players forward more because we have such highly skilled players and a lot of them are people who are very articulate and would enjoy being a little bit more focus, I think, on the players.
I run a business here. I have a F45 franchise gym that that I've opened up a couple of years ago, and I've realized that along the way, you know, you since we're a franchise, I try to differentiate as much as I can to do as much, you know, anything out of the box or whatever. But usually, that's a financial implication on my business also. So all these ideas that you're coming up with, which I'm in head over heels in love with it. I think it's a great opportunity for EuroLeague with IMG, because I know they're all capable of doing it, but there is that financial roadblock. How do you get over that roadblock? How do we get around that and know that there's enough money to be invested to be able to do the things that you want to do?
Well, I can tell you this. There's a lot of interest in EuroLeague in the capital markets. So there's opportunity potentially to bring in growth capital. We have the ability to completely change the way which we, you know, approach and talk to potential partners. And I think there's more, you know, what people here call sponsorship, but I don't. I call it partnership, right?
Right.
So there's opportunity for bigger and better partnership. There's events. I have, maybe I don't know if I'm going to get in trouble if I reveal, you know, too many things, but, you know, I'd like to maybe play a game, you know, somewhere else, like, I don't know, maybe the United States. Not because I think we're going to make so much money playing a game in the United States, but more because I think it makes noise in a positive way. And I think we need to make a little more noise. So there's things like that. You've probably read, it's public, that we're in entertaining discussions with Dubai.
That's obviously coming. I would be remiss not to bring that up eventually.
You're going to save that one? Yeah. Well, I mean, we'll see. I mean, we've had some really interesting discussions with them. But the point of it is, it may or may not work out. But the point is that we're open to a different mentality about conversations like that. I mean, we have a team already in the Middle East, in Tel Aviv.
Right.
And so it's not like it's that crazy for a team just 2 hours from there to be inside our league. What's interesting to me is it's an opportunity to nurture an entirely new audience in a non-traditional basketball country. But there's wealth there. And importantly, they have a really, really nice, brand new, state-of-the-art arena called Coca-Cola Arena. I think we have a similar opportunity in the United Kingdom. So I think there's places where there's venues. I think Paris is going to be really important and part of the mix. And as we begin to go into those kinds of markets, and they're, you know, and I'm not overlooking the Belgrades of the world, and I'm not overlooking the Monacos and the Valencias and the Bolognas. Those are important. So I think the answer to the kind of core answer is I think you're going to see over time that we're going to be able to expand. the markets that we're in. As we expand, that opens up new opportunities on the commercial side of the business, but also the opportunity working with our friends at IMG, but working also potentially with other forms of capital infusion so that we can pay for some of that growth. I don't mean, you know, the growth is going to come organically, Joe, right? The growth is going to become, but we can induce some of that growth by catering better. Now, I will tell you, and I got to admit, I was surprised as I came in here. And every day I come to work, there's a new surprise. Not always positive, but usually positive. Okay. I mean, right.
Like I said, through my company, I've learned that surprises are not always a good thing.
Well, no, but I'm getting a lot of pleasant surprises. All right.
That's good.
I mean, so they, you know, we have a little WhatsApp group, right? And I get a WhatsApp, you know, a few a day, right? You know, and a lot of these are links to something that we've produced or one of our partners has produced that's putting us kind of activating us in the marketplace. And they sent me this pilot program for something called Your League Capitals, I think is what it was called. I forget the name, but it was really, really well produced. And I said, well, who produced it? Well, we did. Really? Wow. You mean we're capable of producing it that kind of quality? That's so nice. This show was, this pilot was done in Madrid. And there was some announcer, I'm going to forget his name, but he was, you know, they're Spanish, but he was really good. And then he was with the co-host of the show was this woman named Sofia Del Prado. And so I'm kind of watching this thing, right? And then all of a sudden they're kind of in different places around Madrid, kind of talking basketball, but also about the city. And now they're on a basketball court somewhere in Madrid and they're playing one-on-one, the two co-hosts. And Sofia has the ball in her hand and she's dribbling as good as you, Joe. I mean, I couldn't believe it. She can ball. She's got ball handling skills, like real. And I'm going, whoa, 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 what's the deal? I mean, she's not just some beautiful woman. She's like, can play hoops. So I was interested and I found out that she was, Sofia actually played basketball at a high level. But she so happened to also, in, I think, 2017, be Miss Universe Spain.
Marshall, let me cut to the chase. Sofia's around the EuroLeague because she's an influencer at my gym. I've got her. I helped her out to get her in the door. She did a podcast with the kid that you're talking about. And you know you forgot his name. His name has got the same last name as me, but his name's Dane. And that's my son.
What?
Joe, yeah, that's my son.
The world just gets so small. What do I know? I'm such a rookie around here, man. They're all downstairs watching this, laughing at me right now because I don't know.
Your son? Yeah, that's my son. And that's when I spoke to you about like the PTI concept and the Manning Night Football, the Manning cast. Him and I, we've always talked about doing something like that together. It's pretty funny.
We're totally on the same wavelength here. And I love the idea of putting people like that, because what came across, I'm just watching this video at home on my phone, you know, but they came across, they came right through the phone. They're kind of there. They were upbeat. They were really articulate. They're good looking and they were representing and sort of emblematic of EuroLeague and what we could be all about and reaching, influencing those next generations.
He's my son. Of course he's good looking.
Dude, he was really good. He was really good, as was she.
He has a way. I kind of learned from him how to commentate games because he was like, I've always been a color guy, but we've been forced into this other commentating role. And so he pretty much taught me how to commentate games where him and I, through this crossover thing and the way I interview players, he's kind of developed that ability to be at that same level with a player. And, you know, most people who interview a player, you know, they start below them and he doesn't care. He's just like, he's going to ask a question. He's going to ask any question. And it's really, I love the show too. I thought it was a great show and the two of them did a great job together. So I was happy for both of them.
And for your audience, you and I did not rehearse this. I had
no idea. No. That's the amazing thing.
That's fantastic. You know, we have a lot of things that the NBA does not have. Number one, and we're using it as our kind of slug line, which I love, which is every game matters. That right. part is core. I mean, that's huge. Number two is the cross-culturalism that we have going on here. I mean, you know, it's sort of like, that's pretty amazing. The first time I showed up here was in 2002 when they hired me as an advisor. That's how I met Jordi Bertomeu and Rosaire and people here and began kind of this long journey that I'm still, you know, kind of, you know, I guess this is the final phase, but it's amazing how things have evolved. And, you know, I walk into a Board of Governors meeting, you know, right? And there's all the, you know, everybody's wearing headsets and there's all these translators. And I'm thinking, what is this, a UN meeting, right? You know, I mean, right? I mean, it was just amazing to me. And I love the fact that there was such a mix of cultures sitting in that room around the same table, basketball being the thing that's bringing, EuroLeague basketball, bringing everybody together. And I really believe in that. And I think that's one of the huge, really special things that we have. You know, maybe football has it, but football is just so big in the scale of it. I like kind of our smallness in a certain sort of way, right? It's more controllable. And our and the nature of our markets is so interesting, you know, and so I really like that. You know, when we were in Dubai, which was reported publicly, so I'm not giving up a secret, the Israelis were there with the Arabs from Dubai. I mean, it's like, I thought that was really cool.
You don't hear that happen very often.
No, and talk about, you know, basketball. We're really are bringing people together. It's true.
I think one of the misconceptions here is that multifaceted or multicultural environment that we have is a negative.
No, it's the other way.
It has to be looked at as a positive thing. And I think the detachment from country to country has made people not be able to find that middle ground. And I just think it needs to be looked at as more of a positive thing than a negative thing. And that's the change of attitude that has to happen.
It's totally right. You're spot on. And think about what that really means as far as EuroLeague being a platform for corporate social responsibility and how we can do good things in communities. For music, different music. For gastronomy. I mean, I'm just on a constant food tour. I'm kind of a foodie, and man, I mean,
we're going to get into that at the end of the interview. Don't worry.
By far the best part of the job. I'm sorry. It is. It's not.
I want you to know I'm over here getting text messages from your office to tell me how much time I got left. I'm like, I got to get to the food part no matter what.
Okay, go.
No. We'll get to the gastronomy thing in a minute. As an ex-player also, I've seen some things. You talked about salary caps and everything else. And as an ex-player, I look at that as a couple different things. I should say an ex-retired or a retired athlete. I think salary caps are a great thing because it's going to bring a little bit more parity to the league, so to speak. I know it's difficult because some teams are sponsored. Some people have backing of a football club or whatever. Within a salary cap, would there be like that MLB, the Major League Baseball concept, where there'd be a luxury tax where teams could pay more under that salary cap? And the second part of that question would be, I love what the Players Association has done as a EuroLeague Players Association, something I've said for 30 years now that they needed. Would there be any type of like NBA pension or a pension fund program for retired players? I know that was, of my 57 years, I've had about 53 or 54 really good ones, man. But
really?
Those three or four where I retired were not the easiest years of my life. So that it's kind of a double-sided question there, and between salary cap, luxury tax, and some sort of players association pension for the future of the players that are playing.
So number one, I don't like the term salary cap because it sounds like we're trying to restrain the wages of our players, which is not how I think of it.
It has an opposite effect, though.
Well, yeah. I mean, the term cap got adapted because of the NBA,
right,
and they called it a cap.
Right.
But what I think we're talking about is a partnership with our players. And it's a partnership where the players should have a vested interest in the growth of the league, and where the collective growth, as the economy of the whole thing gets bigger, so too should compensation going to the players. So to me, it's very important that we connect those two, number one. Number two, the players on the other side, the framework agreement that we entered into, which I think was a very difficult thing to do given the nature of so many countries and so many different systems of taxation and so many sort of cultural references. The fact that we've signed a framework agreement, and we're just at the beginning of it, is brilliant because it's already beginning to improve working conditions for the players, as it should, and things like that. Extremely important to me. We need to improve everything, whether it's our, you know, medical practices, what you're talking about, to begin to create a pension opportunity for players over time. I'm strongly in favor of that. I want to update the framework agreement and continue. It's going to evolve, right? Year over year, we're just getting used to it. But I just met with Boki Nachbar, really good guy, and had a nice conversation there. So we need to develop these concepts together. But the message that I want, there should be minimums, there should be caps. Those caps do have to take into account taxation and the differences between markets. I think that can get done. But more importantly to me, it's to express this legally and in other ways as a partnership with the players. So yes, and I think for clubs that have more resources, certainly we should leave, just like in the NBA, the opportunity for clubs to retain their own players. Certainly there should be certain exceptions if there is an exceptional player that could be potentially playing in EuroLeague who's going to command higher wages. I think we want to make sure that there's flexibility built into there. Maybe there ought to be a luxury tax concept. We're exploring all of the above, where for the higher payroll teams, there's money that's redistributed to the lower payroll teams. I think the objective here is, number one, competitive balance, or parity, as you called it, Joe. I strongly agree with you on that. But there are other objectives. Economic sustainability is important as well. But there's lots of objectives. But I want to see all these areas evolve. I think it's super important.
I mean, even through salary caps, through parity, whatever you want to call it, there's always going to be, whether it's NFL, NBA, MLB, whatever league it is, there's always going to be the smaller markets, as you've lived your whole life with Portland, and there's always going to be less money involved. I mean, but like you said, you try to distribute that money as much as you can throughout the league. And that makes it a little bit stronger. I mean, the EuroLeague's an amazing league just because you have teams with the smallest budgets, like Žalgiris, for example, or Partizan, who come in and they're going to give you a battle every night. It's not like you're just rolling over and winning by 20 against those teams. So with that type of plan, that's just going to make, that makes the league stronger. But it might add in more teams, as you're saying. Would that give it that NBA feel where the regular season would not be as important as it is now, that every game matters?
We got to be careful, right? So, because we don't want to lose that, right? That's
right,
that's
exactly.
So special. I mean, I think more teams is inevitable, but you know, there's not going to be more calendar, is there? These teams play in their domestic leagues. I don't see that changing. You know, you have the issue of the FIBA windows to some extent. You've got, you know, there's only so many dates, and we have to take care of our players, man. They're our core asset. To put the players in a situation where they're being frankly overworked doesn't make sense, you know, where they're having to play too many games in too little of a period of time. And the coaches need time for training, and, you know, so we got to work that out. Maybe we're going to have to think about going to a conference system. Right now, this format that we adapted in 2016, home and home, is fantastic. It's been embraced. It's terrific. It's been really the thing that's kind of propelled us to the next level. At the same time, to get from 18 to 20, 20 to 22, 22 to 24, it's, you know, I don't think there's any magic solution. I think we're going to have to go to conferences. And in that scenario, maybe you play every team home and home inside your conference, and you only play the teams outside your conference, home or away, alternate years. I mean, I just think we're going to have to go in that direction. It's inevitable, because the good news for us is there's demand for licenses to play in EuroLeague from, by my count, 8 different markets, and it could really be more like 10 today. Markets that do not have EuroLeague teams today. So we want to take advantage of that. And, you know, not all these markets are ready, but they're close to being ready. And we want to definitely take advantage of that.
That's good news. It's because the product is like I said, I continue to say that every game matters is a logo that we came up with, I think, just a year or two ago. And
yeah,
even when I'm commentating games, I'm like, it's not only every game matters, but every minute matters sometimes, you know, within that game when you break it down. But I want to finish up on a couple of things. You said that you've been around the league, you've talk to people, but you've taken on that God gave us two ears so that we can listen twice as much as we talk type attitude. And from your conversations, from your involvement with the clubs and with the players and with the teams and everything, has your position as a CEO become more optimistic? Has it remained the same as before? Is it a little bit more pessimistic? Do you feel that you have more work to do?
I have an overwhelming amount of work to do, no question.
Well, but I know that.
Listen, I came here from, 9,000 miles to the West Coast? Is that right?
Yeah. Something like that, yeah. I've been running with kilometers for too many years now.
I mean, we lived here for 2 years back in 2002 to 2004 when Jordy brought me over here as a advisor to your league. And here we are again. I mean, it's incredible. I grew up in Portland. I moved to LA, came back to Portland. I moved to New York, came back to Portland, moved to Barcelona, went from Barcelona to Boston, went from Boston to Bend, Oregon, 8 years there, Bend, Oregon, back to Portland. And here I am back in Barcelona. It's an incredible journey for us. It's an adventure. And so now that I showed up here, I think on the 16th of September, so it's been a short window so far. I am incredibly optimistic. I really am. I mean, to me, EuroLeague hasn't even begun to scratch the surface. The indoor arena business is beginning to evolve in Europe. We have new arenas happening in Bayern for Bayern Munich in Munich. We have a new arena happening in Lyon. I happen to be involved in the development of a new arena next to Camp Nou here in Barcelona. We have one of the busier arenas in the world in Madrid and Wizink Center. There's more new arenas that are coming. And, you know, there's things happening in Paris. So these arenas need content. These arenas don't live by having dark days. And the old model where you build something just for that team and just for that team's game is over. So there's going to be more demand for our content, particularly in these growth markets. You know, our team Alba in Berlin plays in a really nice building. And, you know, this is Zalgiris plays in a really nice building. So arenas are going to have a lot to do with all this, is all I'm saying, as well. So I'm very optimistic. We have some really big challenges. I'm not going to pretend that we don't. We do. We're working things out, I hope, with our clubs, because there are certain clubs that have different perspectives, which would be normal, right? I mean, who doesn't, you know, that's normal. I'm hoping that we can put all of this together by addressing literally what's our event strategy, what's our partnership strategy, what's our market expansion strategy, how can we simplify our governance, and kind of our legal structure, you know, what's next? With FIBA, you know, could we finally find peace with FIBA? I'm certainly optimistic that yes. What can we do to take advantage of the digital streaming and, you know, the metaverse and all these technologies available to us? How can we tell our stories better? This is one way right here. Here we are doing a podcast. Podcasts are big now. This is fantastic. So how do we get that storytelling out there? How do we use people like your son and Sophia to help tell our stories? And, you know, these are all things that, you know, how do we advance, as you talked about, the framework agreement with the players? How do we address financial fair play? We're dealing and looking at all of that at the same time. It's a great ride. I've got a lot of smart people around me, and I'm very optimistic that the outcome of all that, I like to call it EuroLeague 3.0, is something that I'm really looking forward to.
The USA game that you talked about, or whatever it could be, I mean, could that possibly be like an all-star game? We haven't had an all-star game ever, so.
But then, Joe, that would be a game that doesn't matter.
True.
And so my interest would be to maybe show them what it's like to go to a game that does matter.
True. There you go. Yeah, I didn't think about that part of it. That's like the NFL coming over here to Germany or to London.
Isn't it interesting? The Brits, the NFL has been coming to London for a long time now.
Right.
The NFL's, they were just in Germany, right? So the Brits don't even know what the rules are, all right? They have no idea what is the object of the game. They don't understand what is a first down. And they don't understand the yardage mark. They don't understand any of it. Really?
You know how many games I've watched with friends of mine where you have to sit there and explain the whole game?
Yeah, right. Basic things.
It's fun for the first 10 minutes, and then it gets old after a while.
Right. And I mean, I have friends in Paris, and I took them to a New York Yankees game a few years ago. It was like that. I mean, baseball, really complicated to explain.
I don't even bother with baseball.
But it's interesting that the NFL has been a massive success in London. It's been a massive success. I am quite certain that we're going to have a team there. I mean, it just doesn't. I think we may have two teams there in the not too distant future, like real teams.
It's been talked about for years, and it just has to happen.
It's inevitable.
It has to happen. Yeah.
So to me, I'm not saying we're the NFL, but I am kind of. I think that's interesting that they were able to come in to a non-football market and not only make it work, but make it work big. And I think EuroLeague can go into sort of non-traditional basketball markets and make it work.
I'm going to finish this off with a couple of things about you personally, but my major question, I even have it written down on my little thing, and it's the only thing in the entire thing that's in red letters.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, this is going to be a tough one.
Oh, geez. All right?
Because that I've heard, and of course it's been publicly talked about, that you're kind of interim, a one-year gig to be here with the EuroLeague and so forth and so on. Is this a short-term relationship between? Because I'm starting to like you really a lot. I'm liking your vision and your ideas, and I want to make sure that this is going to be maybe a 20-year venture that we're in together.
Well, I'm not going to promise 20 years. That would be I will be an old man in 20 years, my friend.
But how old are you now? I'm 57.
I can't talk about my age. That's like asking a woman her age. I'm 63.
You're 63. Okay.
I'm aging. I hope this is not a short-term relationship.
That's all I needed to hear.
Joe, to bring an American into this ecosystem, even though I've been on the fringe of this ecosystem for a very long time, I know most of the people here. I was quite close to Jordy over the years. I came here, by the way, with Jordy's blessing. It was super important to me. And I think he's terrific. But I'm coming over here with an American mentality. Obviously, that's on purpose, right? They didn't hire somebody from over here. They hired an American. Right. So I think there's a certain expectation that I'm going to look at things a little bit differently, and I'm going to disrupt in a positive way, a change person. I'm going to, I want to stir it up, right? Make things happen. But at the same time, very carefully find the balance. I have to respect cultures. I have to respect differences in economic and political realities from country to country. I have to expect that a really modern, great arena in one place may not be realistic in a different place. I have to respect that the spending power in Moscow or in Belgrade is not the same as the spending power in France or, all these things. And I have to respect that basketball here is, there are traditional basketball markets that are really strong that may not have as much economic activity, but are still really important to the core of what we are. So finding those balances is really important. The balance between business and competition, really important. And I want to make it realistic that every team in your league has a chance. And that means going back to the whole idea of the cap and bringing, more parity on payrolls. So these are things that get me excited. There are things that keep me up sometimes at night. I'm a very early riser in the morning. As people here are discovering, they can't believe the time on my emails. They're like, what? You were awake at 5? What? And I'm going, yeah, I'm already on my second espresso, man. What's the problem? So, I've got, right now I have a lot of energy. I love living in Barcelona. I love going around Europe, especially for lunches. And, some people say, oh, you got all these you know, owners. And you know, I love talking to these people. I'm meeting some really fascinating, interesting people from different places. Awesome. So I think my answer to your question directly is, I hope I stay for a while.
That makes me happy too. We already know about your music fascination, and I was told about it, but I didn't know it was as big as you said it was. I mean, obviously this has been happening since you've been, what, 18, 19 years old. You went off on your own in LA. Now talk to me about the food. Because I'm just like you in that aspect. I don't have any vinyl records sitting in my house anywhere. I can tell you that right now. But when it comes to food, I'm ready.
Well, the food is sort of a problem for my waistline, which is why I've been going to the gym almost every day. So my wife grew up learning how to cook with a Susie Bake oven. This is basically a toy oven. And but it kind of somehow it heats up or something.
Those would never be sold nowadays, right? It just seems too dangerous.
Exactly, right. You know, we're in a PC world. So my wife has evolved, and particularly when we lived in Barcelona back in 2002 to 2004, she went to Hoffman here, and you know, she learned how to make a really nice paella. I mean, she's really a very fine chef.
You have homegrown stuff coming up. I was talking more like country to country.
Well, when we were in Portland, she was a professional personal chef. So she went into people's homes and did kind of dinner parties. So I eat really well at home. So let's just start with that. And being on this great street in Barcelona where here's the bread store, here's the cheese store, here's the fruit store. I mean, unbelievable. The carnicerie, incredible, right? And I'm in France last week. I'm in Lyon. I spent a whole day with Tony Parker and Gaetan and the people there, and it was fantastic. And I saw the Tony Parker Academy, really good day. The next day we had a meeting, Rosera and I, in the morning. And then we had like an hour and a half to kill before our train left. And we went into the most fabulous food market. I've never been in any place like this in my life. My bag was filled with different cheeses that I brought home. And people like on the train were, because it
smelling
was
smelling the cheeses. Right?
Yeah, so anyway, but the thing about the culture here is when I have business lunches, you know, when I move from market to market, almost every time there's a lunch. You know, this isn't McDonald's, man. They're taking me to these amazing, amazing lunches, you know. And so I've had a chance to begin to sort of sample everywhere. So I love being, this is really a gastronomic tour for me, you know. So that and music, it's all perfect.
And you're talking about 3-hour lunches at times, right? It's just like, that's where all the business is done here in Europe. It's mostly done over the lunch.
It's quite extraordinary, yeah.
Hopefully you and I could do one of those when you come to Madrid. Come to Madrid, get in touch with me. I'll take you to one of my favorite restaurants.
I can't wait to see you in Madrid. I will guarantee you that we will get together when I'm there next, for sure.
Sounds great. Marsh, I really loved having you, man. And thank you for your time, your patience, and obviously your sincerity. I can honestly tell you, I was a big fan from the beginning without actually getting to know you. Now that I know you, it's like, to me, you're a breath of fresh air, and you're bringing in a breath of fresh air to an already amazing product, which is the EuroLeague. And I just want to wish you the luck. And like I said, hopefully we'll be having lunch or dinner together sometime soon.
Thank you, man. This was fun.
Thanks, Marshall.
Thanks for listening to The Crossover with Joe R. Lucas. If you like what you've heard, subscribe now so you don't miss an episode, and leave us a review on iTunes and Apple Podcasts. You can also get in touch via Twitter and Instagram at EuroLeague using the hashtag ELCrossover, or on Facebook at the EuroLeague.